JAXA Space and Astronautical Science Podcast.
Welcome to the JAXA Space and Astronautical Science Podcast. I'm your host, Toshihisa Mikaido. After our guest in the previous episode mentioned there are many ways to contribute to a space organization, not only through research and engineering, it felt like a good time to bring an administrative personnel onto the podcast. Today, we feature an administrator, Adi Wenna, who's responsible for much of the communications and intake procedures related to international employees at JAXA. We talk about the experiences he had living in several different countries, what it's like to only have one name in societies that expect at least two, how he maintains proficiency in four different languages, his long path to JAXA, and his passion for being close to science and engineering. Please enjoy. Our guest today from JAXA's Tokyo headquarters, an administrator in the human resources section, Adi Wenna. Adi Wenna, welcome to the show.
Hello, Mr. Nikaido. Thank you very much for having me today.
I've actually worked fairly closely with you for a while now, so it's a bit awkward for me to be asking this, but can you tell me, what do you do at JAXA?
So I'm working at Human Resource Department. I am responsible to provide all human resource-related support to non-Japanese-speaking personnel. There are many categories of HR-related support, ranging from critical items, such as visa application, onboarding from abroad, separation after finishing your work contract, to important items such as taxation, pension, health insurance, research funding, to small things that adds up, like setting up your PC, OS update, work hour registration, and other stuff. I'm also involved with all COVID-19 related internal communications, such as protocols, translations, announcements, and other relevant items.
Sounds like you're doing quite a bit there. I did notice that you went over a few topics that I think in general, let's say, a lot of people might not find exciting, such as, tax and protocols and that sort of thing. Do you enjoy doing that kind of work, going through the protocols? Do you find it interesting on a personal level?
I think it depends on each person what is exciting. To me, learning new things is always exciting. And I can always find something exciting within the taxation, pension, and other things that people might not think as interesting at the first place. And of course, it will be interesting if you get a bill of tax or you get a bill of insurance. Then it's interesting for everyone. Or when you are almost retirement age, that's interesting. It depends on time, place, and occasion, I guess.
Yeah, I suppose the information does become more and more important to not only the employees, but probably also to you and everyone around you as well. So having a grasp on understanding a lot of this information, I think, is probably very helpful just in life in general, perhaps. It's good that it sounds like you do enjoy it, though.
I think we are not getting younger. We are getting closer to retirement day by day.
Oh,
like it or not, it will come.
A few more years, maybe.
Hopefully a few more decades.
So can you tell me roughly how you organize your day? Because it sounds like you have a lot of different potential tasks anyway. Do you split up the day, like you work on taxes in the morning and pensions in the evening? Or how do you organize your day, if you have any sort of system itself?
I don't have any particular system at the moment, but what I usually do in the morning is, this is relevant to the COVID-19 related stuff that I do, is that I scan the news for any developments. I scan the news first, and then I scan all relevant government agencies, such as the Ministry of Health, Labor, and Welfare, because they're responsible with all COVID-19 protocols in Japan and on the entry protocol from outside Japan to Japan. And then I check the Ministry of Foreign Affairs so I can have the latest idea about visa application and other stuff. That's usually the first hour. And then if I find something interesting, I'll take notes. And once in a while, I will send like an email containing a package of information to everyone. such as, okay, I might find that, okay, the government of Japan is approving the new vaccine or the new bivalent vaccine, or they're not approving the experimental drug or whatever. Any relevant information about COVID-19, usually done within the first couple hours. And after that, I'm going to go to the task that I have for today, which may depend on what is going on. For example, right now, I am helping to fix some of the workflow for intake documents for foreign nationals who wants to go to JAXA, regardless of their status. It could be a JSPS scholar. It could be a research assistant, which is a part-timer, basically. Or it could be a full-time employee. I'm doing that right now. And I'm working with the other department as well. And then at night, usually at overtime, I don't recommend overtime, of course. I don't usually recommend overtime, but I usually use my overtime to do things that I think needs to be done.
I see. So if you are going to do overtime, it's usually the tasks that you find important, but haven't necessarily been given to you by a supervisor or are on the list of things that already need to get done, basically.
Yes, that is basically something that I think I need to do, not what others give.
Mm-hmm. I guess that's, it's a good time to work on those sorts of tasks if you're quite busy during the day.
Mm-hmm.
I know the visa applications particularly can be very difficult, especially with the COVID situation.
Mm-hmm.
Every individual country will have their specific rules and specific citizenships mm-hmm. will allow for more or less freedom when trying to enter Japan or if they're already in Japan, whether they can work for a government agency or not and mm-hmm. how much freedom they have. And I know it can be quite a hassle. But what do you find most difficult when working with visas and visa applications?
Uncertainties of the review process, because the review process could be as long as 3 months,
mm-hmm.
but as short as a week or two. And there's been a case where there's a candidate who is supposed to join us in the coming 5 months after I start application.
Mm-hmm.
And I started a little bit early, like 5 months before intake, because, the immigration websites mentions 1 to 3 months of review time.
Mm-hmm.
But I was given the visa 2 weeks after that, but the visa expires in the next 3 months, which that person cannot get into Japan. And I already mentioned it on the application form that this person will come to Japan by this date, which is mm-hmm. 4-5 months away from now, from the date of application. And they still give me something that is not working.
That was a 90-day visa?
No, that's a COE, a certificate of eligibility for longer stay person,
mm-hmm.
which is, that's a little bit difficult. I mean, I have to go there again. I have to explain the whole thing again. And that's uncertainties about the review period.
Uncertainties.
I think this is common not only in Japan, though. But mm-hmm. This is the most difficult.
Let's say, hypothetically, one of our listeners is actually thinking of coming to Japan and working for a Japanese company, whether that's JAXA or not.
Mm-hmm.
If they wanted to apply for a visa, let's say, in this hypothetical situation that they've already got some kind of job and they need mm-hmm. to get the visa application done.
Mm-hmm.
Can you run us briefly through the process of what they would do? In this case, let's just say we don't know what country they're from, so it's applicable to most people in this case.
Okay. First thing that I usually ask a candidate is, mm-hmm. does the candidate has any blood relation with a person who has Japanese citizenship or who is a Japanese diaspora? Usually that's the first question that you ask.
Mm-hmm. If they do, they have a much easier time getting in then.
They will have a much easier time because they will be here by family visa, family-based mm-hmm. visa. And usually family-based visa are way stronger than work-based visa.
Mm-hmm. They don't have the restriction of you have to be working and in a specific field.
Yes, but you have to be a good husband or you have to be a good wife. To some people, it could be a good idea. To some people, it might not be the best idea. It
Does this have to
depends.
be a spouse or can it be?
A son or a daughter, yeah. Could be parental.
Would
So your
this
parents
work
can be
with like an
genetic.
uncle or a grandparent or anything like that? Or
A
is this a more direct?
A grandparent might work, but the review process is completely different.
I see.
Yeah, a grandparent might work because that works with Japanese diaspora, in especially people from Brazil, because they have grandparents or great grandparents, and if they can prove ancestry, then in some cases they will get a visa. Okay, so usually that's the first question, and if it's in a lot of cases, people answer no to all the questions, no blood relations, whatever, and then we can start moving to work visa. And after that, the candidate will need to submit all necessary documents, of course, and all necessary forms to whoever's dealing with this on the human resource department. And then that person will apply it to the immigration. And as I said, the review takes between 2 weeks to 3 months.
Sorry to stop you. These necessary documents, will these generally be specific to the company to which you apply, or are there ones that will be the same for basically any company?
The same with every company. If it's based on work visa, yeah.
Can you give us a few examples of some of these necessary documents? You don't have to go through the entire list, just a couple of things that people would need to submit.
They are okay, so let me just go back a little bit. And of course, it depends on what type of visa you would like to have or you're eligible with. So the highest tier of work visa is highly skilled professional. Then you will need to prove that you are highly educated. So you need your PhD or master diploma. You need to prove that you will have X amount of salary, and you will need to prove that you go to this school that gives you more points. For example, like you went to Harvard, and okay, you get extra point because the highest skilled professional is based on points. And there are other types of work visa, such as engineer slash international relations kind of thing. There's this visa, engineer visa. This is for entry level jobs, and you just need to submit your a copy of your passport, a photo of you, and your personal information through the forms that you fill. Or you can do a researcher. If you are a researcher, then you just submit these forms containing your personal information and a picture of you and a copy of your passport. That should be sufficient. The rest of the application and the rest of documentation will be done by the accepting organization.
I see. So the amount of documents that the applicant actually needs to fill out, probably it's not too many.
Yes, but it depends on what kind of visa you want to get and in the first place.
And you mentioned the point system. I've actually seen the chart for the point system before. I think there's actually a lot of different things that will raise or lower your points. Some things that you might be able to change or alter, and then other things like I think your points go down with age, which isn't really something that you can control. So we have a lot of scientists around us, but I haven't talked to anybody who knows how to control that yet.
We are not that advanced yet.
Not yet, no. But yeah, I guess the point system, depending on who's applying, it might seem a little bit unfair or difficult to go through because yeah, it relies on education, age, salary, and I think there's also like a level of Japanese that
A
you
level
could
of
have
Japanese, yeah, you
to
need,
get more points.
yeah, if you speak a certain level of Japanese. If I remember correctly, it's N2, which is a fluent speaker, which will be equivalent of if you score 90 plus on TOEFL test.
The N2, this is that's level 5 to level 1 being the top in those tests for the Japanese language test for international people, correct?
That is correct.
Okay, and N2 is sufficient to get, I guess, max points, or would N1 be better in this
I
case?
think N1 will be better. I don't remember exactly, but N1 is always better. And in some cases, some companies might require you to have N1 qualification. If you are N2 is fluent and enough for most business communications, but N1 is professional level. So something like lawyer, you understand something about law, but in Japanese, that's N1.
Mm-hmm.
It's higher degree than just business, than just debating, than just in writing emails.
So I guess if somebody wants to come to Japan, and this will be sometime in the future, it would be good to have a PhD, a high salary, be very young, proof of a high level of Japanese, and
go to a good school,
and have gone to a high ranked school as well.
So yeah,
some of these things it's a little bit harder to change, but yeah, these interesting
points. I have advised someone to change. Okay, let's not submit your PhD because someone did a master in Japan.
Mm.
So let's just submit master degree so you can get points because you study in Japan. Plus you get points because you have master.
I see. So the PhD and the master's, there's not necessarily a discrepancy between the two in terms of points?
There are differences between master and PhD.
Oh, okay. There are differences in points.
But if you're doing master in Japan, you've got extra points because you are doing it in Japan.
Okay, so studying in Japan gives you a higher amount of points. So if you've already been here or are living here and applying for a future visa.
Yes. And plus, if your school in Japan has the additional point, then you will get extra, you get higher points. You possibly can get higher points than having your PhD. So there are tricks it depends on each person, but there are tricks that you can do to help you. In case of JAXA, I will support, of course.
If anybody's applying to JAXA and you are accepted, Adiwena might be the one helping you out, helping you get to Japan and start your work here at JAXA.
I'll be in touch. Looking forward to have you on board.
You did mention at the beginning that one of your jobs is to help a lot of the international employees. And I think you also mentioned translating as well. And I want to get into that a little bit more in a moment here. But I guess a big part of this is that a lot of the international employees do not have what most companies would consider a sufficient level of Japanese at this point, correct?
That is correct.
So do they ever have any trouble with their visa because of the limited language ability, or is that generally already taken care of in the documentation process?
If you're talking just about the visa, mm-hmm. then everything has to be taken care of.
And if it's not the visa, would there be problems doing things like renting your first house, opening your own bank account, and that sort of thing, right?
Yes, there's mostly this kind of small things that adds up. Okay, how to register my work hours, how to update my OS on the PC, how to get myself a cell phone contract, how to get myself a bank account, mostly something like that. But it's small things, but it adds up. Like, mm-hmm. oh, I get a mystery bill from the city hall. What is that? It could be pension, could be insurance, could be tax, could be anything. Could be your, this is about Corona. Just to explain to all of our listeners outside, in Japan, you get a ticket to book a vaccination slot for your COVID-19 vaccination. But the ticket is in Japanese.
I see. If anybody wants to go get the vaccination there, they would have to bring their ticket.
They have to bring their ticket and they have to register using the ticket serial number. And you get a ticket by post, by snail mail.
Snail mail, yeah. So it actually comes to your mailbox or your mail slot. I guess with whether it's bills or whatever it is, most of the information would just be in Japanese. And if you, especially for people who just got to Japan, I mean, I think they would have, definitely a lot of trouble because it's all in Japanese. And it's probably, I guess, a higher level of Japanese than even most people who I would assume studied outside of Japan would have when they first get here. So yeah, I guess that would be rather difficult. Something you just mentioned about registering cell phone and a bank account. I remember you talking about this at one point. I overheard you having a conversation about this, but is it true that you are required to have a cell phone number to register a bank account and you are required to have a bank account to register for a cell phone?
That is correct. this is a chicken and egg problem. It happens in a lot of countries, actually. Apparently, One of my Italian friend who used to live in France told me that you need an address, which is apartment, to have to open a bank account, but you need a bank account to rent an apartment. So that's another chicken and egg problem. It happens everywhere. And in Japan, you need a cell phone number to make a bank account, but you need a bank account to open a cell phone number.
And this has to be a local bank account, right? Within Japan.
Within Japan, because salary can only be paid to a local bank account.
So how do you end up getting around this problem?
Fortunately, JAXA issues every personnel a cell phone.
So you temporarily register the work cell phone, and then once they have a bank account, they can go get their own cell phone if they please.
Yes, that is correct.
I see. I wonder how other companies that don't issue cell phones work around this.
I've heard some anecdotes that you can use your landline, because some companies still give you your own landline. Or use a rental cell phone.
Rental cell phone. So there are some workarounds, some more difficult than others.
Yes. But fortunately for us, it's a little bit easier because we issue everyone a cell phone instead of a landline.
There's a lot of difficulties and nuances there that make it get into a cycle of having to do one thing to get the other done. And it's kind of like the you need experience to get a job, but you need job to get experience sort of situation, right?
Yeah, it's a chicken and egg problem.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you a little bit about translations. I understand that you speak or have a quite high level of knowledge of several languages, actually, not just English and Japanese. We'll get into your history later. I think you also speak Indonesian and Chinese and maybe something else.
Not for now.
Yet. Okay, not for now. So four languages. Which ones are you most proficient in, would you say?
Okay, just go back a little bit. So just to go back a little bit, I am native Indonesian speaker. And I learned Chinese before. I live in a Chinese-speaking country before. I've been living in Japan for the past almost 15 years. So professionally speaking, I think my English and Japanese are better than my Indonesian. But this is strictly on professional, because I use a lot of professional words at work. And these are the language that I'm most acquainted at when I have my higher tertiary education, in which you generally learn higher level of concept and languages.
Yeah, that makes sense. Maybe if you're having a casual conversation, so your first language, I guess, Indonesian, would be very easy for you to have a very casual conversation with friends. But since you probably aren't using it very frequently in business settings, if someone asks you to write a business email to whomever, you know, it would be either English or Japanese would be actually easier to do in that case.
Yes, I need to think more, actually. Yeah, but I found something interesting as well, since I have not returned. So I just got back from Indonesia a couple of weeks ago.
Welcome back.
Thank you. And the last time I visited Indonesia was before Corona, which is 2019, which is, I left, the last time I went back was about 3.5 years ago. And I found out that language always evolves. So I found out that I start to missing some language, Indonesian language. I start to miss some of them.
You mean like
some phrases,
slang or just regular?
Slangs, mostly slangs.
Mostly slang, yeah.
Yeah. But I found out that there are some words that I just don't understand, because these words were not prominently used when I was younger. I mean, it's still in the language, of course, but it was not used as prominently right now. And sometimes meanings can get twisted a little bit due to evolution of the language.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess especially in the social media era where everybody's trying to make something go viral now. There's all these new sayings and new words. I can't keep up with any language.
You can. It's a process. I mean, it's a revolving process, and you have to be part of it. Consume the social media or any type of media. You can either consume it or you can, you know, became part of it as a creator, if you want to, but you have to be part of it in one way or another.
I guess you always have to be talking to people, keeping up with the language, with how they are constantly changing these days. So it was, you had that kind of a tough time in Indonesia then, in that sense.
Yeah, I have some stuff that, hey, what does this mean? I need to look up. I need to look up on the dictionary. It's like, okay, at least, at least I try to keep up though. Like, considering that we all have social media accounts these days, and we all watch YouTube at some point of our life. So I try to keep up by reading Indonesian news and news in Chinese as well.
Hmm. So you're making sure to keep practicing, I guess, all of those languages in some form or another.
Yes, at some point, yes.
Yeah. Do you use Chinese often, or is that become rare nowadays?
It's really rare compared to other languages. It's, mm-hmm. I only speak Chinese to, well, Chinese colleague. And I don't have that many Chinese friends in Tokyo right now.
Ah, okay.
So that's why I watch Chinese YouTube a lot.
To keep up with that way.
Yeah, to keep up with the Chinese.
So when you are making or translating documents for the international employees here, let's say you have a Japanese base for a document and you need to convey that information to the international employees, what do you personally feel is the most important point, or what do you pay specific attention to when you do translate a document?
Make it as close as the original. This is in general the idea of what is a translation, so, but make it as close as possible and try to shorten it as much as possible without losing any meaning, of course. Mm-hmm. Because people tend to prefer shorter passage.
Yeah, I think especially in the business world, you know, everybody's maybe they're busy trying to get something done on a deadline, and you know, if somebody sends you three novels to read in an email, that's it's gonna make it more difficult. And I think people tend to skim once documents start getting too long. So that makes sense, yeah. But I think it probably is difficult keeping some of that information both brief and as close to the original as possible when you consider the cultural underlyings and specifics to certain languages. Like, you can say a lot in Japanese with the two kanji characters, two of the Chinese characters, that maybe would not get conveyed with, you know, even a full sentence in English sometimes. Do you have any sort of practice that you do to get around this sort of scenario, or is it really like case by case for you?
Of course, it depends on the context, the whole sentence of what I'm translating. But I usually have this mental stash of set phrases for set phrases in Japanese.
Because you go through so many different documents from government agencies, or, you know, documents about visas and pensions and taxes and everything, I think you end up finding about very peculiar bureaucratic processes in Japan that most people, even those who have lived here for their entire lives, have never even heard of before. Is there anything, any specific, I guess, piece of information there that really stood out to you and remained in your mind that you can share? And this could be interesting in a funny way, in a good way, and maybe in a bad way.
So I've been studying law recently. I started to study law, and I found out that you don't need to have a written contract for the contract to be considered valid in the law.
Really?
But you still need to have something written on the paper regarding your salary, your work contract period, and other items. But you can always say yes without even signing it. So you read it, you can say yes, and it works.
So if you have an unsigned contract from a company, it may be legally valid, you're saying?
That is still like legally valid.
Oh, interesting.
Because getting into a contract doesn't require signature. It still works even if it's verbal. And the other way is the same too. If in the worst case scenario, your boss said you're fired, that is actually valid as well.
I guess so. But
not emotionally speaking. I mean, emotionally speaking, it is very, very valid. But legally speaking, if someone said you're fired, then the word itself has the power to fire you.
Whether they're hiring you or firing you, it does have to be somebody who has the authority to do such things, though.
Yes, that is the idea. But if that person said you're fired, then you are actually fired.
I guess the difficulty there is that if you did not have a written contract specifying one of these things one way or the other, it would be difficult to prove if such a situation ever went to like a legal case or whatever.
Yeah, but in most cases, most employer will want to sign the written contract, of course.
Yeah, I think most places will definitely have those contracts. So if you end up working for somewhere that does not have a contract, it's probably good to bring a voice recorder with you then. So.
That will be a good legal advice. That will be a valid legal advice.
Yeah, I guess there might be some gray areas, though, with what you are and aren't allowed to record and share and use, but it's good to have some records that you were hired for a specific period of time and salary.
Yes, that is correct. I think this happens because laws are not necessarily reflect what is going on right now, but it could be like that in the past. Mm-hmm. Because the law is written maybe 50, 60, 70 years ago, where people can just hire. Let's just say 60, 70 years ago, Japan doesn't have a great economy yet. It was after the war, and people just want to get hired as a day laborer. Mm-hmm. So sometimes the employer will just go to the street and pick five dudes. Okay, five dudes, come here. Let's get this job done today. That's why it's written like that on the law.
I think that makes sense.
There are reasons for that. Definitely, there are reasons for that.
Yeah.
But it's not valid right now, but it's still there technically.
So there's a, I guess, historic backbone to why it works that way. But to be safe, most people are using written contracts. And I think most people who are in the law professions will probably say that the written word in legal cases is probably the strongest one. Mm-hmm. So whether or not you have a recording of the spoken word, the written one seems to be more better for most situations. Yeah.
I think the key word here is verifiable. Verify it. If you can verify it, if it is objectively verifiable, then it will work the best on any matters.
Hmm. So you don't actually necessarily need a contract, but you should have one.
You should have one. Yeah. So you can always receive a flyer saying this is what it is. Mm-hmm. Do you want a job? Yes. And then you get the piece of paper and then you start working for the day.
Speaking of work and careers here, can we get into your career history? Not just your career itself, but you know, go over sort of your life history. You already mentioned that you were born in Indonesia, but you know, if there's anything more that you'd like to add to where you were born, raised, went to university, any place you want to talk about that you worked before you came to JAXA and how you actually ended up at JAXA?
Basically, I kind of raised myself, except financially, in Taiwan and Japan. Most of my formative year is actually outside Indonesia.
Oh.
So I was in Indonesia until 14. And I graduated middle school. And then I moved to Taiwan to continue my education. It's for high school and I'm there by myself. There are a family. One of my aunt live in Taiwan with her husband and my cousins, but they live about 2-3 hours away from where I live.
So at 14, you were living in a different country all by yourself?
All by myself, basically. I mean, in case something bad happened, I can always call for help. Mm-hmm. But in most cases, I take care of everything myself. Huh. I go to hospital myself. I go to the bank myself. That caused a little problem because I was a minor.
Yeah.
But yeah, but generally speaking, it works.
Oh, 14. That's quite impressive.
Yeah, I just get lucky. There are people who start younger than me mm-hmm. at 12. So they go to primary school in Indonesia and they go to Taiwan by themselves when they're 12. And I got lucky. I am financially supported, fully supported by my parents. So I can...
I see.
I don't have any difficulties there. I don't need to work. I don't need to... I just need to study. That's it. It easy, actually.
Is this a common thing for people who grew up in Indonesia to go to Taiwan or maybe somewhere else after graduating elementary school or middle school?
At least for people around me and mm-hmm. in around my community, it is quite common to pursue education abroad after a certain point. 12 is not that common. 14 is not that common, but after high school, most of the people that I know pursue education outside. Could be in Australia, could be in the US, could be in Canada, could be in Taiwan, Japan, or any other country. But 14 and 12, I mean, after primary school and middle school, not that common, but still happens.
So you were in Taiwan from 14 until how long were you there?
Until 18. So 4 years in the school. So the first year will be to learn the language and then 3 years of high school.
And what did you do after that?
After that, my parents decided to send me to Japan.
So you came here when you were about 18 then?
Yes, 18. I came here when I was 18. 2008. That's a long time ago. Yeah.
Long time ago. And have you been here ever since?
Yes, I've been here ever since. So after I came to Japan, I don't speak a word. Okay, just to go back a little bit, mm-hmm. I don't speak a word of Chinese when I go to Taiwan. Mm-hmm. So I can only write my name, say thank you, and scream police, which is important. And oh, and say where's the toilet, which is very important as well. And same with going to Japan. So I have to take a year. I have to take a year in Taiwan to study Chinese. Mm-hmm. And in Japan, it took me 2 years before I can go to university. And this is because, this is, sounds like an excuse, but to get into university in Japan, you need to take an exam in Japanese. So you have to first understand enough Japanese to understand what the exam actually asks you.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense, yeah.
So it's an excuse. I know people who did a lot within just a year, but it took me 2 years.
Okay. I guess having a base in Chinese when you lived in Taiwan probably helped a little bit, but I think Japanese is one of those languages that's so different from most other language in one way or another that it does take quite a long time to learn. So, you know.
Yeah, the pronunciation is completely different. The grammar is completely different. And there are many other stuff that is completely different. The mm-hmm. only thing that carry over is at least I don't have to start kanji from scratch because I'm already used at looking at characters that has meanings and different ways to pronounce.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the only advantage that I can say.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, it's a difficult language. So whether it's 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, even if it takes you 5 or 10 years, you know, if you can get a strong handle on Japanese, I think that's already quite an accomplishment. And I know that you are already very proficient. So 2 years before you were able to get into a university with that.
Yes. And actually that's because I went to a full Japanese course.
Mm-hmm.
Like I choose, well, maybe let's just say my parents advised me and I took their advice that I take a Japanese curriculum. So all of my, I'm not an international student in the sense that, oh, everything's in English. No, everything is in Japanese. The reports are in Japanese. And I realized that 2 years are bare minimum to write a report. Because if you think about it, and this goes the same with my Chinese, because it took me a year to study Chinese.
Yeah.
What I'm expected when I was in Taiwan and when I was in Japan is I have the same proficiency with local people. In Taiwan, local people means 15 years of education. I'm expected to have 15 years of Chinese education within 1 year. Maybe not exactly 15 years, considering that you start from primary school. Mm-hmm. So I'm expected to learn 9 years worth of language.
Yeah. It's very, very high expectations for international students. And I think it's a lot of pressure too, because, you know, this most people probably in the same school, in the same courses that you're taking, have studied that language for, I guess, somewhere close to 20 years or whatever.
Yeah.
And in some form or another, you know, from when they're just a little kid until now, and getting a hold of, you know, the professional language, the cultural undertones and all that stuff. And then you have to, you know, sort of pick that up in no time. Yeah. Right?
So I have to catch up, basically, because the professors and the teachers, they expect that, of course, a lot of them are very understanding, but you are expected to have the same output with locals.
Yeah.
That's the thing. Doesn't, in a sense, it's good because it's fair, but on the other sense, it creates a lot of difficulties because, as you said, there are subtleties, there are cultural items that I just don't get to experience when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And of course, you cannot beat 12 years of education with 2 years.
No, it's probably going to take a little bit longer. So, yeah.
Unless it's mathematics.
There are some people who don't speak any of whatever language it is and just completely pass every mathematics course with 100%.
Yeah, there are people like that. That's why mathematics are, that's why scientists say mathematics are universal language.
They are. I'm not personally very good at that specific language. So.
As long as you can do addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division, you're good.
Okay. That's I can usually do those ones. So. How about you? Are you very proficient in the mathematics or?
Oh, yeah. I learned something from all of the things that I learned. I learned that the best thing is not do it yourself, but find out how to do it. So about mathematics, I found out this thing called calculator. And of course, if you need to know more, such as, okay, how to divide things by zero, why it's error on your calculator, you can always Google it and go to YouTube and find some explanation. I think that's more like it these days. It's not like you have to know it, but you know how to figure it out.
Yeah, I guess there's so many potential resources nowadays to learn things like math. And I guess this also applies to languages and everything else when you have applications or videos and tutorials all over the place. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, these days, not like the old days.
The key is still consistency.
Yeah.
And perseverance.
Consistency is key. Perseverance is a rover.
That is a name of a rover. Maybe that rover is good at language too.
Could be. So you said you went to university in Japan. How many years were you in university?
4 years.
Four years.
2 years of language school.
And then four university.
For my undergrad.
And what did you do after that?
And then after that, I find a job in the auto industry. So I was there for about 4.5 years. The good thing about Japan is, especially if you are working at a manufacturing company, is that they teach you everything about manufacturing.
I guess closer to an apprenticeship in some ways than just a job.
I guess this is more like management track, because you get to, so everybody starts over and everybody is management track. So there's no separation between management track or non-management track, at least in the past maybe 15 years. So everybody's management track, I get to experience 4 different departments within 4 years.
So it's a lot of experience, and it goes hand in hand with what you were talking about earlier with, you know, being able to learn new things and enjoying that process as well.
Yes, that is, you get to learn every aspect of the company, basically. So my first assignment in the car manufacturer is I go to the shop floor. I built a car with my own hands.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like I built car from scratch, but I'm part of the assembly line.
Yeah.
But I learn about production techniques, about what is production engineering, what is assembly line, And then I go to accounting, in which I learn how a company made its finances. And then after that, I go to a dealership. So I sell cars. Literally, I sell cars. So from these processes, I know how a car is made. I know how an entity is making money, and how to sell that product. So this is like the whole cycle.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not everything, but you can get a big picture. And then the final assignment was a project assistant project manager in the purchasing department. And I learned so many production techniques there, how a steel is made. I saw a steel made from iron ore. I saw a blast furnace.
So you really got to, I guess at this point, you're getting to a lot of these very specific pieces that you didn't probably weren't able to experience when you were on the assembly line.
No, yes. I can say that I have a comprehensive crash course in manufacturing, in all aspects of manufacturing.
So you might be able to make a car if you had the resources nearby to put them together then.
Yeah, I can figure out what I need to do, yeah.
So it sounds like you really enjoyed working there though. Is there any reason that you left that you can share? Or is it just you wanted to experience something new and sort of step up?
Actually, I always wanted to join the aerospace industry.
So you were interested in space and flight in general?
Yes. And when I was asked by the company, the car company, so that car company makes a specific type of engine that they don't make it anymore at the moment. But that specific type of engine can be used to power a plane. And the reason why the one that's used in a car
can be used to power a plane.
Yes. And the reason why I want to join that company, because I think this engine probably has potential for aerospace use. So my idea is I want to be part of the aerospace industry. But since I don't get a job at aerospace industry at the time, I will try to I'll join this company with the goal of maybe in the future I can, and if the company wants to, I can, you know, we can work together and transform a car company into an aerospace company. Because that specific engine is very good. I've seen some numbers that are very, very good. And there are some people who already did that kind of conversion. And they're still alive. So the engine works.
That's good to know. Yeah.
And I'm happy they're alive too. And there are people who made a manual on how to convert that. That's why I think this is okay. This is something that is viable at least. That's why the reason why I joined that car company is I want to work in aerospace. I didn't get a job. Maybe we can work together and transform this company into the next level.
Did they show any interest in that when you did? I guess you talked to them about it
No.
At some point. Oh, yeah. Okay. So this was more of a long-term potential dream here, or a goal that you were thinking about. Yeah.
I think they probably are interested, maybe, but they're more interested not because of that, but because of how I think like that. Maybe that's the case.
We did have one of our previous guests. I'm not sure if you were able to listen to the episode, but one of our previous guests is working a lot with sort of aerospace and designing airplanes and whatnot. And, you know, some of the information that came up was really comparing cars to airplanes, and there's a huge cost difference in designing cars is when compared to designing airplanes. So I could see how it would be difficult to convince a company that is profitable in the car industry to enter the aerospace industry. But at the same time, I also think, you know, there's a lot of future potential going on there. So
yeah, you can always start small, maybe just the engine that is already in production.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's an area of interest.
Yeah.
You were interested in the aerospace industry prior to, when did you first have interest in this? Was this after you came to Japan, or was this sort of just something you are always interested in?
I'm always interested, but there are several events that affects my interest. Of course, I think it started when I was a kid. When I was a kid, I watched a lot of, let's just say, Japanese popular culture that involves giant robots in space.
Okay, I think a lot of people probably already have an image in their mind of that.
Mm-hmm. Giant robots in space. There's a lot of Japanese contents that's like that. And yeah, and that's why I'm interested. I want to be an astronaut and a pilot. Back then. Yeah, but when you grow up, you realize that it's probably not the most realistic thing that happens. You don't see transforming robots right now. So it's not that realistic, I guess.
I mean, maybe if you go to Odaiba, you might be able to see some, but...
But can you ride on it? Can you pilot it?
Let's go later and find out.
For the listener, by the way, we have some giant robots in a place called Odaiba.
There's
FYI, if you came to Japan, if you go to this place called Odaiba, there's a giant robot.
I used to live fairly close within, I could probably jog over there, mm-hmm. Less than 10 kilometers away or whatever. So I could go see the robot whenever I want. I never tried getting in, so I don't know. But
I think that will be problematic.
It could be, yes. So you had this interest since you were younger, and then what did you end up studying in university?
I studied business in university. And I want to add a little bit that the other event is I was working as an intern in JAXA before.
Oh, and when was this? University. Oh, well, you were a university student. You interned at JAXA.
I interned at JAXA for the summer of 2011.
Oh, wow. So you've been... JAXA much longer than I have in that sense. Much longer than most of the people we've had on the podcast too. So
yeah. So it was a decade ago.
Yeah.
So yeah. And when I was studying in university, I studied business. So I learned all other aspects of space exploration, mm-hmm. from the society side, economic side, business side, human development side, philosophical side, and other aspects that you get to appreciate once you get certain point, once you reach certain point of maturity. Of course, there are many jobs that will benefit society, like being a doctor, civil engineer, architect, firefighter, or other type of jobs. Mm-hmm. But from what I learned in university and from all the other aspects that I start to get understanding of when I mature, I realized that space exploration is one of the most beneficial in all aspects that I'm aware of, at least. And it goes even more because it will benefit humanity as a whole, as a species, not just certain society, not just certain group of people.
Mm-hmm. A lot of those are probably very long-term goals that might be far out in the future. But yeah, as you say, it goes, I guess, in some sense, beyond a global advancement, because it will be an ultimately interplanetary, there's a lot of things going on in that industry. And at some point, we expect that, everybody be involved. So very valid point. But I was just wondering there, because you mentioned when you were a kid watching robots fighting in space, that you wanted to be sort of a pilot and astronaut. But you ended up going into the business in university, which I guess you could still probably get there from that path. But was there any specific reason that you decided to go on the business side of things as opposed to attempting to go to university for a more direct path to piloting space robots?
I washed out from the entry test. I guess that's the most direct answer.
Okay, so you...
I did apply to some... stuff.
Okay, so business wasn't necessarily your first choice then.
But that is only after, that is on my final year of university, because in Japan, sometimes some airlines has their own flight school. And I applied to some of them, but I didn't make the cut. So yeah. So yeah, I have to admit defeat in that at some point, right?
I suppose so. As I've discussed with you, I also recently applied for JAXA's astronaut applications, and I did all right, but yeah, maybe I'll go into this in a future episode at some point. But
yeah,
there's, you don't always make it when you apply for things, but I think it's good to challenge yourself in that way. So after the car company that you mentioned, you were there 4.5, maybe 5 years, roughly. You say you applied and got into JAXA after that?
No,
I
worked at a startup.
Oh, okay.
For a year, and then I go to JAXA.
So is there anything that you would like to say about the startup in particular, or is that just an area we'll gloss over?
This is, in general, an advice for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be a good idea to learn about labor laws before moving to a different company. There are many things that could be implied for what I say, and that's the only thing that I will say.
There were some difficulties.
I will not go that way. It's was open to interpretation, but okay, it's always a good idea to understand your rights.
Yes, it's a very complex issue, of course. So
I will not comment anything more than that. I will not say it's negative or positive experience.
I guess it's you can take it as a learning experience either way.
It is.
That's what we can say.
I agree with you 100%. It's a learning experience.
It's a learning experience. So we did, I think, touch on why you wanted to apply to JAXA in the first place, partially due to space robots and an interest in aerospace.
Mm-hmm.
But if there's any other reasons, you're welcome to bring those up as well. Was there anything specifically, now that you've been working at JAXA for, I guess, 2 or 3 years now, what do you like best about being at JAXA now that you're here?
Let me just go back a little bit for the why JAXA part.
Okay.
Because JAXA is not a for-profit corporation,
mm-hmm,
which in general will have less conflict of interest. I'm not saying that for-profit corporation is bad and government agencies are always good. No, it doesn't work like that. For-profit corporations brought unthinkable breakthroughs from various skills and know-how and other acumen imported from different industries. But as a whole, I believe that some pursuits are better to be done without the complexities of business world.
There is a lot of overlap that does end up happening, though. So that's we do have a lot of private industries also opening up in the space development. And some of them are making a lot of progress. You still prefer an industry like the space development industry to be not privatized? How would you put that?
There are different. I think there are three different stuff that we can discuss here. We can have the number one will be industrialization of space that I support. And then we have the commercialization of space that I also support, because we need an economic ecosystem. We need a business environment where everybody can thrive.
Mm-hmm.
But I do not agree 100% with privatization of space, because it's something that is not tangible. Who owns the sun? Nobody owns the sun. Can you patent the sun? No, you cannot patent the sun.
It gets exponentially complex the further you go into that.
Yeah. So, but I agree 100% with commercialization of space development. I don't disagree with that. Industrialization, good. You got the economics of scale. You got breakthroughs that we think was unthinkable. We don't think was even possible just a decade ago. We'll have more and more people participating. We could have more inclusion, especially for people from, let's just say, countries that doesn't have a space program.
Mm-hmm.
That is a good thing, but I don't always agree 100% with privatization.
Yeah,
and I'm not saying that corporations are bad, but some pursuits are better to be done without complexities of business world. And we need something, some entity to play the good guy role. I personally think it's like that.
And you feel that JAXA was a good candidate for this, and that's what led you to want to apply?
Yes, for JAXA specifically, yeah.
Now that you are here, hopefully to at least some degree, it's living up to your expectations. What is it that you specifically like about being here?
Well, it is actually beyond my expectation.
Oh, that's great to hear.
Okay, for starters, the labor conditions in here is way better than most corporations in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you have a lot of holidays, twice the amount of holidays than most companies. And there are many smaller things like, oh, how you get paid overtime. In different sense that, of course, you get paid overtime in most companies too. But in JAXA, you get a little bit extra. And to explain that, I need an hour to explain that. So I'll just skip over that. But you get more money for overtime.
That's definitely a plus. Yeah.
You get more holidays and you get more. There are terms and conditions, but let's just say you are pregnant and you're having a baby, then it's a paid holiday in JAXA.
Mm-hmm.
In most other companies, it's not a paid holiday. For the delivery itself, it's not extra, mm-hmm. but you get paid 100%.
Oh, okay. I see what you mean.
Some other companies, we'll give you extra. We'll give you this period. Mm-hmm. You can take it off. No repercussions, no retaliation, no whatever.
Mm-hmm. But it's a percentage of the salary or
a certain percentage.
Sometimes none, yeah.
Yeah, because the law doesn't dictate that period to be paid. And some companies, we'll just follow the law. Some companies go above and beyond. And JAXA goes way above and beyond. It's a huge plus. And huge there are many plus. Other smaller, maybe not small, but more detailed labor conditions that I can talk about. But I'm not here for the benefits. I'm not here just for the benefits. The perks are very nice. And working here aligns with, maybe a lot of the listener can already understand that working in aerospace is my life goal and my ikigai. It aligns well with my life goal and ikigai.
Yeah.
But what I like
ikigai is basically your purpose in life. So
maybe the listener, you can either Google ikigai or I can explain later. So after working here for almost 3 years, what I like here the best are the people that I met, at least the people that I've contacted so far. Most people I meet here are very helpful and offer solution, regardless if that person is within the human resource department or different department. For example, when I called someone at different department to learn about something new, mm-hmm. about employment related item, about work, I never had someone saying, "I don't know," which in Japan usually translates to, "I don't want to help." Instead, most people will introduce or at least direct me to someone who knows, mm-hmm. or at least who might know. So the amount of helpfulness is even better within the department. This doesn't happen often because of Corona, but sometimes I got invited to brainstorm sessions. I felt that I'm part of the team and contributing because of this. People are also appreciative. They appreciate your work here. Of course, this may as well depend on what department you are working.
Yeah, I guess it always depends on the department, the people, the team, so many different things. But your experience in that area has been very pleasant so far.
Yes, very positive.
That's great.
Yeah, and the surprising amount of autonomy that I have. Yeah, as you said, this depends on your supervisor, your department. But my supervisor just gave me a general outline of what I need to do.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just call it a mission. How I execute that mission is up to me. The only thing that I need to ask is if it involves money. That's it.
If you're spending a budget that often comes from tax, they can be quite strict.
Yes. And yeah. Most of the money that I ask are not even high, like maybe 1500 yen, 2000 yen or something like that. So yeah, very quick approval.
That's $20, I guess.
Yeah, $20. Depending on the exchange rate, maybe $15 now.
It could be, yeah. Always changing, but.
Yeah. So it's always like that. Like I was asked, my transport. I need to go to X place. Then, I need to get reimbursement, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the only thing I need to ask for approval.
Yeah.
And I can choose to work overtime or not. I think I mentioned this a little bit earlier. So I can choose to work overtime or not.
Mm-hmm.
So I can do tasks that someone assigns me during the work hours, and I can use my overtime hours to work on projects that I think needs to be done.
A project that you think need to be done that will be beneficial for everyone.
Yes, that's the goal. And the reasonable amount of workload and freedom to arrange my work hours allows me to take night classes for attorney qualification.
You're trying to get attorney qualifications?
Yes, but this is not attorney at law. This is qualification unique to Japan. So it only concerns labor law and social security law.
Mm. Why do you want to get those? Is this just so you will have an extra backbone of knowledge to fall back on for your current position? Or is this something that you're aiming at doing in the future? Or maybe both?
I think it could be both, because at this point of my career, I think I need to have a professional level knowledge to provide an even better support for all, at this point, non-Japanese speaker. But maybe in the future, I can expand my service, expand my support to all personnel. So with this kind of qualification, well, I can explain more about pension, basically. I can consult about pension because this is Social Security. Yeah, maybe in the future. And this qualification allows you to open your own law firm. So maybe in the future, I can try, you know, to be a consultant. Or
so there might be a Adiwena pension law firm in the coming days.
Maybe. Yeah, hopefully it will make a boatload of money too. But I, and the beauty of it is if I want to, I can do that while still working at JAXA. I have a lot of autonomy that I can have my own secondary career. So
it's not just a potential part-time job on the side, but you could actually have a second full job or full business if you wanted.
Yeah, but it has to be on weekends.
Okay, so it could not interfere with your current position is the
I can do the consulting on Saturdays. And that's hopefully in the future, and hopefully I do pass the bar exam.
Well, good luck with that. Yeah.
I took the bar exam this year, and let's just say the results are not, I'm not going to pass.
Have you already gotten the results, or is that just how you felt about taking the test?
I checked the answer the following day. Yeah.
Okay. So.
So, but it exceeds my expectation.
Okay. As long as you're making progress there, then I think that's already a huge step towards that goal.
Yeah. And because my goal for this time is very simple, is I understand what the question is, I understand what the answer is. I just don't know which one is the correct answer. That's my expectation, because this is a bar exam.
Yeah. It's not easy. So going there, not expecting to pass your first time, having a good understanding of what's being asked, the potential answers, and I guess the experience of taking the test. So if you do it again next year, you will be a lot more prepared mentally for that test as well.
Yeah. And I can make better plans, better study plans, of course. So yeah, that's hopefully in the future. And right now I do food delivery worker.
So as your side job, you're doing doing food deliveries?
Yes, I do food deliveries right now. I go to a certain food delivery service website and I register myself. And I do it mostly for health reasons, because just to make everything clear, in Tokyo, most food delivery workers use bicycle to deliver food. Getting paid for anything is always nice, of course.
Yeah.
And I've been making a nice amount of money. But the biggest benefit is I'm losing 15 kilograms.
In how long?
In a year.
In a year. That's quite amazing. We don't have video for this particular podcast, but I will say that you are looking in much better shape, much healthier than a year ago. So
yeah,
amazing progress.
I just also had my annual health checkup 2 months ago, maybe. And I just get the result 3 weeks ago. And I am very, very satisfied with the result that I have.
This is much better than last year's results.
Much better liver function, much better LDL level. I think at this point of my life, I start to care about those numbers too, not just the money I make.
There's other numbers that get more and more important as you get into the 30s or and beyond, I think.
Yeah, like your liver function, your blood sugar level. Yeah, and the improvements are amazing from what I've seen.
A large part of this is because of the riding the bike and doing the side business for so long.
This is mostly this. And of course, I get to learn many other things. I found many good restaurants around.
Oh, yeah. I guess you would if that's what you're doing.
Yeah, I found many good restaurants and I can practice bookkeeping. I'm actually a licensed bookkeeper, so I can practice bookkeeping for myself this time. So in the future, if someone asks me, hey, how to report your own tax, then okay, I can always advise them. And I learn about, I make good, well, let's just say decent amount of money. Mm-hmm. And I lost 15 kilograms. That is maybe about 15% of my body weight.
A lot of people pay to work out where you are essentially getting paid to do some form of cardio.
Yeah. It's not for the faint-hearted, by the way.
Well, if you do it enough, you'll have a stronger heart. So
yeah, that's the idea. Could be a long ride. Could be like 50 kilometers per day, maybe about 30 miles per day. But it's not a straight line. Yeah, remember, it's not a straight line.
Yeah, yeah. You get to choose how much you do, though, correct?
Yes, because I am my own boss.
Okay.
There are some debates about does food delivery worker a worker or are they private contractor? But at this point in Japan, it's private contractor, so I can do whatever I want. So if I don't feel like it, I can just turn off the app. I can go home.
You mentioned like learning about the different restaurants and what's good. So, you know, if you deliver a certain thing to some people and the person who answers the door looks, really fit and healthy, you say, okay, I'm going to go back to this restaurant and get my own food.
There are some very, very creative restaurants, let's just say it that way, that caters to different type of people. It's Tokyo, 10 million people. You have a lot of demand for everything.
I don't really have a deep knowledge in restaurants or culinary arts myself, but I guess you'll learn a lot doing that job. Yeah.
Yeah. And I visit exotic places, actually. I pass through many exotic, let's just say exotic places. Like I found out that there's a military base near Roppongi, which is the clubbing district of Tokyo. And that's a full base.
Really? So it's close by there?
It has a helipad. Yeah, and I went to the American Embassy complex to deliver food to American Embassy personnel before.
Can you get in the embassy or do you have to hand it off someone outside?
For the embassy complex, I can get in. For the base, I have to hand it to the guard.
I see.
Or maybe MP, I don't know. So yeah, I get to see interesting things too. I get into the building where they house the McKinsey, the consulting company McKinsey's house before. And I went to a building that used to house Google and many other interesting stuff, many other places that you wouldn't get in unless you do something like this.
It sounds like there's a lot more benefits to the food delivery than I would have thought. You get a lot of exercise, you learn a lot about food and local geography, and you see a lot of interesting places, maybe even meet a lot of interesting people.
Yeah. India, I think, is perspective, though. Mm-hmm. I think I can only do this because I'm blessed, or at least I'm lucky that I have my primary career in JAXA.
And you're allowed to do a side job and don't have to necessarily do a lot of overtime.
Yes. And if your main career is food delivery, I don't think you'll be able to appreciate all of this. You'll be too busy.
maybe, yeah.
Or you probably don't have the mental capacity because you have to chase your deadlines. You have to move very fast or you don't make money at all. So I think in the end, it depends on perspective. What kind of reasons you're doing it.
But it does sound like you're getting a lot out of it. And congratulations again on the health checkup results there, that you're making a lot of progress.
Yeah, I mean, 32 pounds is not a joke.
So I guess next year is going to be even better results.
I do hope so. So the idea is, since I'm my own boss, I can choose when I want to do it or not. Mm-hmm. So I don't do it when it's raining, but it's been raining a lot in the past few weeks.
Oh yeah, we just had a typhoon go by the other day, right?
Yeah, a massive one too. So
a lot of rain.
It depends. If there are a lot of typhoons coming, maybe you'll see me grow horizontally next year.
Oh. Yeah, well, good luck with keeping up with the progress there. I wanted to jump back a little ways here to ask a question that came up. So this podcast, we speak in English, but you said that you were in Indonesia until 14, Taiwan until 18, and then Japan since then. But it doesn't sound like you were in any country where I guess you would expect that you would learn such proficient English. Did that happen in Indonesia, or at what point did you get so good at speaking English?
I went to international school.
Oh, well, you were in Indonesia? It was an international school?
Yeah.
So the first 14 or so years of your life, or I guess whenever school started, then you would have been using English, at least at school, more than Indonesian?
In middle school, at least, because I went to international school during my middle school. That's why maybe you can still hear a hint of accent here. So my middle school, I went to international school for my middle school, which is year 7 to year 9 in Indonesia. So it's 633.
633.
So 6 year primary school and then 3 years of middle school.
But that's only 3 years learning English then?
Yeah, but in Indonesia, the English learning usually starts earlier. Like from year 2 or year 3, if I remember correctly, we start to have English class.
I see.
Like English lesson in school. Yeah. And let's just say my parents are very passionate in my education. So I take English lessons after school.
Mm-hmm.
And there are English books. There are English TV show.
That's actually one of the better ways to learn, in my opinion, because it captures... hopefully, anyway, if you're watching something interesting, it captures your attention to such a high degree.
I learned about a car that is driven by David Hasselhoff. That car can talk back to him.
So that's how you learned English, through?
Partially. And there's this show on certain channel that tries myth and then busting it. And there's a lot of explosion in that show. So it's a fun way to learn, let's just say it that way.
Yeah,
it's explosion, yeah? Hosts are always saying, protection, 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 keep it safe. And if you're trying to blow something up, keep it safe.
Yes, definitely. That's if you're going into a potentially dangerous situation, you want to mitigate those risks.
Yes.
Even protective, if it's explosion.
Yeah, protective equipment and then distance.
We have, you know, a fairly big English learning culture in Japan as well for kids. I think they start to learn from the elementary school level now, I think. But I wouldn't say that there are a lot of people who are highly proficient in English. Is there, and I'm not sure how familiar you are with the English learning culture over here, but is there any difference that in your mind as to why you were able to learn English so well in Indonesia, and maybe most Japanese people are having a more difficult time over here?
Not enough explosions.
So no. Using more exciting learning techniques.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say, is more effective way. I mean, learning grammar and learning basics that you do at school, it's of course, it is very important.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to think about it. How does kid learn Japanese? How does Japanese kid learn Japanese? You have to apply the same logic because it's still language.
Mm-hmm.
Japanese kids learn Japanese through cartoons, through comics. You can use the same logic. American kids or a British kid, Australian kid, they learn English through cartoons, through comics, or some TV show geared for kids. Yeah, with less explosion, hopefully. Probably I don't set a good example here about explosions, but I mean, it's always fun, isn't it? With the high-speed camera.
Yeah, I guess on that television show you mentioned earlier, they would be using that a lot to show the explosions. So you get to understand the language to sort of work up to that explosion.
Yes, and it's always funny. The narration is always very funny.
My son's actually been watching Curious George recently, and he copies a lot of the... We're watching in Japanese, though, but he copies a lot of the words that they're saying there. So I think that's, like you're saying, you know, they learn so much from things like cartoons because it's really the things that capture their interest. And I think also the things that they're able to watch over and over again. So it gives them a really good sense of, you know, what is going to happen next. And sometimes they already know, but, you know, knowing what happens next and the feeling of being able to predict it is also really helpful in learning there, watching the same thing over and over. Or it seems to be for him anyway. And yeah. I guess maybe it was for you with the explosions.
Everybody has different interests. This is exactly the same answer that if someone asked me how to learn Japanese effectively as an adult. Mm-hmm. Find something that interests you. If you like explosions, explosions doesn't mean you... If you see a lot of explosion, doesn't mean you can learn the language.
Metaphoric explosions, maybe.
Yeah, metaphoric explosions. You can read your favorite comic in Japanese if you want to, or watch something in Japanese with Japanese subtitles.
Yeah, exactly.
To help you. So yeah, there are many methods. The idea is consistency. And how to be consistent is make it fun.
Yeah, I agree with that. That's precisely what I would say too. If someone, and it could be any language that they want to learn, keep it interesting, entertaining. And I think a lot of the time using tools such as television shows is highly effective. Although there are some caveats there. Like if you're watching a medieval fantasy drama or whatever, where they're talking in very specific dialects and using old style. And this could be, you know, whether it's Japanese or English, you know, there's language that they used in the past that even if people can understand, it would sound very strange today. And, you know, if they're talking about dragons and stuff like that, it might not be as beneficial as more of a slightly more modern based setting. But yeah, I do agree that using something interesting, something that captures the learner's interest, such a high degree, can be very useful, especially if you want to be consistent.
Yeah, that's the general idea. You don't tell people who start learning English about Shakespeare, right?
I mean, yeah, unless that is their very specific purpose for learning language. You know, that's something that you leave for much later, I think.
Yeah.
Shifting gears a little bit here, I wanted to ask you about your name. So we've been calling you Adiwena. I introduced you as Adiwena, but you have no last name. My understanding is this is fairly common in Indonesia. Is that correct?
Yeah, this is actually quite common in Indonesia. Fun fact, the first two presidents doesn't have a last name too.
The first two presidents in Indonesia didn't have last names?
They didn't have last names.
On a more global scale, I think this is very rare. In Japan, at least, almost everyone has first name, last name, usually no middle name. But, you know, there are plenty of documents. I'm sure you've seen so many of these with the work that you do. Mm-hmm. But a lot of these documents or systems are basically, they have boxes where you have to enter in your first name and your last name. And there's character limits. There's whether it's single byte characters or double byte characters. And there's all these different things, but in your, and you know, so I think a lot of the international employees and people from overseas have trouble with this, but yeah, especially for you, you have nothing to write in the last name box or maybe the first name box, depending on which one you consider Adiwena to be. And I would assume that this makes filling out documents to be extraordinarily difficult. And this would probably occur maybe not only in Japan, but maybe in, even if you're using English, you know, where they require a last name, and it could be whether you're writing something by hand or online. I guess this is a two-part question here. It's kind of going on for a while, but how do you feel when this situation comes up? And Do you have any technique to get around this in most cases, seeing as you've experienced it so many times?
For the first part of the question, I don't feel that deep about this because I'm so used to it right now. Mm-hmm. But there's a good article on Vice magazine / Facebook presence media that explains this. So maybe if you are interested, if you can try to Google Vice single name Indonesia. You can find some things that describes my feelings. Maybe I don't feel as strong as the author, but yeah. And how to mitigate that? How to fix that? How to provide a fix? It in Japan until 2014, I usually separate my name Adi Wena like that. But after that, when I get accepted to that car company, mm-hmm. They use dash, and I figured, hey, dash actually works, and it works better. Because I don't have a last name, right? So a dash usually works better.
Yeah, it's like a non-applicable sort of dash.
Yes, non-applicable sort of dash. So I start using adiwena.dash. And for English-speaking countries, in most cases, I've been to several English-speaking countries. So in most cases, they ask me to put FNU and then put a bracket and write first name unknown.
They register Adiwena as just your last name.
Yes, and first name unknown Adiwena or FNU Adiwena. My experience in English-speaking countries are like that. I think that's a good workaround. Usually I Google before I make an application for something important like visa. Mm-hmm. Then I just Google. I Google the embassy first. And if I don't find anything, then I'll just call the embassy or equivalent authority, and just I don't have a last name. I just say like Madonna or like Prince. I don't have a last name, and then usually the embassy people will just explain, oh, usually this is what we do, blah blah blah, something like that. Yeah,
I guess if the organization is large enough to which you're applying, they may have dealt with this issue a couple times in the past. So
funny thing is, the car company that I worked before, I had a chance to meet with the human resource people there, and he told me that our car company is almost 100 years old, mm-hmm. and you are the first guy who doesn't have a last name in the past 100 years.
Wow. Yeah, I guess you could consider that an achievement of some kind.
I should get something on my achievement box.
Achievement unlocked.
Something like that, yeah.
First person in 100 years to have no last name to work there, so... And that's, I think that was a pretty big company that you worked
at. That is a massive company, 40,000 people. And if you think about it, 100 years, they probably employ at least 500,000 people already.
I guess if any other, maybe Indonesians with only one name or anybody else, the only one name is listening, they can use some of that advice, either, you know, splitting your name or using a dash. And, you know, for specific important documents, you do want to, you know, call and check ahead. When you applied for your visas, you called and asked them beforehand?
Yes, that's usually what I do, because that is something that you must not miss.
Mm-hmm. And were they okay with just writing the one name, or did they need like a dash or something in there?
Oh, depends on which country, but for English-speaking countries, they want me to put FN.
Yeah, the English-speaking countries. How about in Japan?
In Japan, usually a dash is fine.
A dash was okay.
As long as the characters is recognized in the PC.
So it was mostly for the digital registrations then.
Yeah, as long as it's recognizable.
Just want to get into a few final questions that I usually ask every guest that we have on here. One of these is I like to ask if you have any notable hobbies or interests outside of work. And I guess you've already gone over a few things that you'd be doing, such as your food delivery side job and everything. But if you have anything else, any notable hobby, anything that you'd be doing recently for fun or entertainment, I would be interested if you'd share that with us.
I like riding vehicles that has two wheels on it. Two wheels or more, not one wheel vehicle. Yeah.
That would be interesting if you did food delivery on a unicycle, though.
That will be highly unusual and probably dangerous.
I would expect more tiring as well.
I would agree on
50
that.
Kilometers a day on that might be rough, yeah, in a typhoon.
Definitely not want to do it on typhoon. So yeah, I like to ride vehicles that has two wheels. could be human powered or could be gasoline powered. So yeah, I have a motorcycle and I have a bicycle, and I've done several tours with those vehicles before by myself. Yeah, actually a lot of people ask me, hey, do you do group tours with everyone, right? Like a riding tour with everyone? I prefer to do it myself, actually.
Oh, yeah. What do you like about doing it yourself as opposed to going with a group or anything?
I can do whatever I want.
I guess that's a good reason there.
Let's just say, okay, I go to a cliff with my motorcycle and then, oh, this is so awesome. I just want to take a picture here, or I just want to have a quick break here, and I just can stop whatever I want as long as there's no one else in the road. Mm-hmm. And it's not a dangerous cliff. I can just walk my bike there and take a picture of my bike. And I can just have a quick break, maybe enjoy a coffee that I buy. And, you know, just relax, enjoy the scenery. That's the ultimate me time for me. So the solitude, it's not that I am a solitary person, but sometimes I enjoy the solitude.
Probably a lot of people out there. Some people really hate being alone. Some people want a lot more alone time. So you don't have any reservations with being alone for long periods of time then?
Corona test that limit.
But you still enjoy the traveling by your motorcycle all by yourself?
Yes, by myself. Because it gives me a lot of freedom.
Yeah.
I can do whatever I want.
Enjoying the scenery, enjoying nature, enjoying... do you go to any specific places when you do that?
Actually, I've been to almost all over Japan.
Try and travel to a new place every time, or do you have like a normal route that you do?
I always try to go to new places every time. Mm-hmm. So I've done Kyushu, like the whole Kyushu. I've done the Shikoku, I've done the Chugoku area, I've done the Kinki area, I've done the Hokuriku area, I've done the Tokai area, but I have not done Tohoku and Hokkaido yet.
The colder places where maybe your bike will get stuck in the snow or something.
I didn't have the time to go on summer yet. Because you have to go on summer. If you go in winter, that's suicidal.
So, yeah, but you've been to almost every prefecture in Japan now then?
Yeah, almost every prefecture, except Hokkaido and a couple of prefectures on the north. And with cycling, I have a favorite place. It's called the Shimanami Kaido.
Why is that your favorite place?
It's one of the most beautiful cycling road in Japan. And it's got a lot of facilities there, actually. The local government knows that this sea lane, this road, is very good with cycling. So they build up a lot of infrastructure that supports cycling there. They're the first... So the road there is painted. So the road paint on the edge of the road is painted blue there, actually, to guide cyclists. Usually it's painted white in Japan, but it's blue there to guide the cyclists. So there's a cycling path there integrated mm-hmm. with the road. And it's beautiful because it's Shimanami. For people who've never been to Japan, Shimanami Kaido is a chain of islands between the Japanese main island and Shikoku Island in the southwest part of Japan. So it's a chain of island, and you can cycle through all chain of islands. The total length is 80 kilometers, and it's beautiful.
It's very, very beautiful. Stop on some of the islands, and they have facilities there that you use.
Yeah, you can take a lot of breaks if you want to, but just remember that it's 80 kilometers. And depending on what time you start of the day, you might not be able to finish until dark.
Yeah.
It's not like you cannot ride in the dark, but it's an island, so you don't have a lot of lighting there.
So you want to make sure that the light on your bicycle is a good one.
At least it's bright enough, or if you want to, try to reach the end before the end of the day.
Yeah, that sounds like good advice.
Yeah. It's super dark.
So, and you do this often?
A couple times, twice with bicycle and once with motorcycle.
I guess the 80 kilometers on the motorcycle would go a little bit faster.
Yeah, it's 2 hours, 3 hours, maybe less, because there's it's a highway.
Nice hobbies there.
Yeah, and I like to tinker with my bicycle and motorcycle too. I do basic maintenance on both, and I learned so much about how machinery works by just opening up and closing some bolts.
Is this kind of come from when you worked at the car company, or is this like a separate hobby?
Both, actually, both, because I like to understand how things work generally. In the car company, I learned that all the basic rules of physics applies. And this is something that most people maybe don't realize, but all basic rules of physics applies in all types of machinery. So if you think about it, a gear is just a seesaw, a lever, basically. It is a lever, but it's shaped like that, so it can turn in a circular motion. That's it. If you combine different types of levers, then you got different types of leverage, which in turn is a gear. It's the same amount of work, but you change the time, so it's easier. That's why you have the gear ratio. You just replace a human leg with an engine, with an internal combustion engine, to know how a car works or a motorcycle works for that respect. Yeah, and it's cheaper actually. I just might go to a hardware store, buy my own oil, and it's cheap. In the end, it's cheaper. It's just messy. Just need to buy some good cleaning product. That's it. Buy a mechanic soap. There are some products that probably you can find on YouTube that's worked really well with cleaning up grease.
Good advice for anybody looking to, open the hood of their cars or look into the gears of their motorcycles there.
Read the owner's manual first.
And read that. Yeah, make sure you get
Make
as much
sure.
information of that as you can. You don't
Yeah.
want to take out the wrong thing. So.
Yeah, do not take out something. Generally speaking, do not take out something that you are not sure you can put it back.
Look, I didn't even need all these screws here, you say.
Yeah.
Just
It's not
happened
the
to.
company is not cheating you by putting all that extra screws. Yeah. Most of the in most cases, the screw is there for a reason. And then mark the screws. You have to mark the screws to ensure which one goes where. I think that's the most basic idea. Mark the screws and read the manual first.
One more of these questions here that I like to ask at the end. So we have had some people in kind of administrative positions before, but I think you are the first person who is technically an actual administrator who's been featured on this podcast. And I generally ask the guest if they have any tools or resources or recommendations that they can make for people who might be interested in the kind of work that they're doing, who don't have access to the resources immediately that you might get through an organization or anything like that. But if somebody was interested in doing the kind of work that you're doing, whether at JAXA or let's say any other scientific organization, for example, is there anything that you could recommend to them to do to either learn more about how to get such a position or get more skill required to properly work in such a position or?
Less about resource, but it's more about resourceful. I have two types of answers for this, by the way. And it's more about resourceful than resource. A lot of people ask me, "Hey, Adi, how did you get hired in a space agency?" And my answer is really simple. You go to www.jaxa.jp, you scroll down, and you find the word career opportunities, and then you click on it. There's an English page too. For admin position, maybe more likely on the Japanese page than English page, but if you speak Japanese, you go to www.jaxa.jp, scroll down, find the word. As simple as that. Yeah, and of course, this is an amusing way to tell someone how people get hired in space agency. I also follow up with mentioning that most people don't realize that a space agency is looking for diverse type of skills. A space agency is not run by people with PhDs. A space agency is run together by many professional support personnel. An astronaut still needs salary calculation. A researcher still needs someone to control research budget. An engineer still needs a buyer that will do all contract with the supplier. A space agency still needs an exceptional marketing professional to inspire people. As long as you have the will and resourcefulness, there are many ways you can thrive in a space agency. Maybe at the first step, you can look at your own skill, find a job opening that will fit your own expertise, and perhaps we can work in the near future. This translates to all other scientific agencies. First thing first, if you're not on the science or research side or engineering side, if you want to contribute, just go to the website first, scroll down, find career opportunities. Click on it, read it, and see if you match. If your expertise is a match to that role. I guess that's the first step. This is resourcefulness, more about resourcefulness than resource.
Yeah, I guess that's true. There's probably a lot of people out there who, you know, just think from the outside, oh, how did you get that job? And maybe even if they want it themselves, maybe they've never even looked at the career opportunities up on a website.
Yeah, that's as simple as that. And I want to add one more thing about the first part of my answer, about the hiring part, about how to find this out. I mentioned earlier that I was an intern for JAXA in 2011. Mm-hmm. The reason why I was an intern is there's a break between my classes and I go to the career office in my campus when I was in uni. I go to a wall, a notice wall, and I see, oh, they're looking for intern, summer intern 2011. Mm-hmm. I look at the entities that are looking and I saw JAXA. And it was like, whoa.
A space agency. Lined up with what you wanted to do, yeah.
Yeah, a space agency. Why not? I already had an internship on that summer with the Congress of Japan. They call it the Diet. I don't know why, but they call it the Diet. And mm-hmm. I already have an internship with the Diet. But I saw this, and okay, I have to do two internships this summer. So yeah.
Oh, you ended up doing both of them.
Yeah, I ended up with the Diet. I didn't exactly lose weight there, but yeah, it's called the Diet anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And I did the JAXA internship. In that one summer. So it's like going to school anyway, actually, because I go to work every day. And the reason why I get that is I look at the wall. Basically, I look at the wall, I see the word JAXA, it's like, hey, what a chance. So be resourceful. At this point, we have internet in our palm. So be resourceful. You can be resourceful if you want to.
Yeah,
back then, we have a wall.
Yeah. You had to go to the wall and look at the presented opportunities.
Yeah.
So I guess on that note, let's say that one of our listeners, they have a particular organization in mind that they want to work at or intern at or whatever, but they do go to the website or the wall or whatever they have, and they look at the presented opportunities and nothing matches their current skill sets or the job that they initially intended to do. Do you still think it is of value for them to attempt to apply for a position if it's not being advertised? And let's say in this case, we're just talking about in Japan, because I think the answer might vary slightly depending on the country.
No. In Japan, generally speaking, most employer does not accept cold email. So you cannot just cold calling or cold emailing your resumes to entities in Japan. My advice is either A, you wait while you try to make yourself more skillful with whatever expertise that you have. You can expand your skill portfolio, or you can lower your expectation in the sense that, okay, as long as I get into this kind of organization, I don't care which role I'm doing, as long as I can do it. You can always do that if you want to.
I guess, if your interest is the organization or field itself, then that might make sense. Although your answer was an outright, a flat out no there. The particular person considering applying might also really need to consider the time investment versus any risk reward there as well. And I doubt that there's a lot of risk in applying for a position that doesn't say it's open, but if you can get your resume and everything together in 5 minutes and send it out, then, you know, there's probably no big downside. But it's, yeah, as you said, it's probably unlikely that it will work out in you getting a job. But there is one scenario that's actually come up on this podcast. In the second episode we had with Elizabeth Tasker, she brought up that when she applied for JAXA, the type of work that she wanted to do wasn't specifically being advertised, yet she was able to fulfill the needs of one position being advertised, and she was able to sort of do a back and forth with JAXA, which allowed her to expand the position for which she applied. And I think this is quite a unique case, because she was already, you know, fully qualified for a position that was being advertised, and she wanted to do more beyond this. So I suppose this might be a potential option for people applying to such organizations as well. You know,
yeah, I think that's
qualified for something that they do want. And then if what you want is different, you can add that on top and talk about that later.
Yeah, I think if you already get yourself your foot on the door, like let's just say you are on an interview, on the final few words, you can always say something similar if you want to. You can prove that you are at least a very proactive person and you're looking forward to take more responsibility. You take ownership in that, and you have enough skills and expertise to do that as well. I think you can make some adjustments, but you have to get your foot within the door first.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think that's quite rare in Japan about Elizabeth's case, but it might happen. Yeah. But as long as you are doing the job that you apply for 100%, I think that's the basic requirement.
I mean, yes, there's definitely a lot easier to apply for something that they want, that they're specifically looking for someone to do, and then maybe go on beyond that.
Yeah.
This question here, I normally ask it to researchers, but when it comes to an administrative position and human resources, the answer might be a little bit more difficult or perhaps more simple, depending on how you go about answering. But if you suddenly had a near unlimited budget, so somebody said, hey, Adiwana, here's $1 trillion, please put it toward JAXA's administrative field and human resources, and do something to improve it or how you feel would improve it, what would you use that on?
I will double everybody's pay.
That's nice. So you wouldn't make everybody's pay 100 times more, but just double?
No, I think there are way more complexities if you make that kind of change. 100 times more is way more complex.
Mm-hmm.
So I think doubling will be a good start. For the budget itself, although I work in administration, I'm not 100% confident that I can handle that money at this point of my career. So I'll just put it in a bank or any type of investment vehicle that is safe.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just put it on everybody's retirement account.
So
double the salary first, of course.
Double the salary. Everybody will say, I'm going to retire as soon as possible.
If I give them 100 times the salary, then yeah, people will just retire in the next few months.
Yeah, but well, yeah, they say money magnifies people's personalities. So, you know, maybe very generous, kind people will, if they did get that money, they'd be more generous, more kind. But you also have the other side of that. So, and I think it's probably better for most people, maybe, to have more gradual progress in,
yes,
in every area of life.
Maybe doubling is a good start.
Yeah.
And then maybe just keep it that way. So starting salary doubles, everything doubles.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, and your salary step, so you have different pay grades and it just doubles from there. And if possible, maybe I want to make, I don't know, maybe I will start a program about educating person working in the admin side of everything. Because it will be great if you have a basic knowledge in science. Because if you have basic knowledge in science, you can understand what researchers are talking about. you'll be on the same, you won't be on the same level with the scientists, but I think most researchers will be happy to know that there's someone on the admin side who understands science and building up with that basic knowledge. If you are curious enough, you can learn more from the researchers you're working with.
Just being able to talk with them, yeah.
Yeah, just being able to talk with them is something amazing, because most researchers in this organization, they are working on something that has never been done before. And with the basic science knowledge, you'll appreciate a lot more. You'll be appreciate of what you learn and what JAXA is doing. And remember, you are learning from people on the bleeding edge of science. I'm not saying that doing this is a means to an end, but if you have basic knowledge, I'm not saying that basic science knowledge is a means to an end, but if you have this basic knowledge, you can use this effectively to have an amazing professional connection with many researchers, which in the end will help you a lot with your job as admin, and as a whole, make JAXA a more effective agency.
Especially with the international researchers in your case, if you had enough of a basic knowledge in whatever field that particular person was working in, you know, they could actually ask you for, you know, input or help on something. And because a lot of the researchers, again, especially the international researchers, don't necessarily have as easy of access due to the language barriers and other things, hiring people to help them with work. So if there was someone on the administrative side that they could ask directly, you know, hey, can you help me with this science thing? And, you know, they explain the problem and you can understand it well enough, then you could actually be a great resource towards their research as well. I think,
Who knows, you might share a Nobel Prize one day.
Maybe, as long as you're one of the first three people on the papers that get published there.
So. Oh, yeah. Maybe you need more than just basic education.
Well, I don't know. Maybe, you know, if it's just you and one other person and it's a really good paper, then you could get one. So, maybe. But yeah, using a budget for, okay, doubling everyone's salary and then, you know, learning and education, in Jax's case, of the sciences and engineering, getting a pretty good education in all of those fields so that you can help all the people that you're working with.
Yeah, for the admin people, I think this is a two-way street. Science is a two-way street. If you know how to talk with the scientists, then you'll have a better time. And you can have you can probably have personal satisfaction by learning new stuff. The bleeding edge of science, the bleeding edge of human knowledge.
The final question here that I just want to ask you before we wrap up is a very open-ended question, but I'd like to know if you have any interesting fact, theory, suggestion, or any kind of information that you want the audience to think about after they're done with this podcast. Well, I'll leave this fairly open, so it doesn't necessarily have to be administration. It could be about space or science in general, if you have something that comes to mind.
I will say that even a small amount of knowledge in science, high school science, it will change our perspective. In most countries, we learn about prism when we were in middle school or high school. And when you see prism, it's a diffusion, a white light diffused to a rainbow. And the reason why it happens, and some materials absorb the wavelength. That's why you see some blacks between the spectrum. And that is the barcode of life. That kind of technique is called spectroscopy, that is used by most astronomers to see the composition of a planet's atmosphere. Something like that will change your perspective. Even something as simple as that, it will, the basic science is used on all advanced fields. It's still relevant at all these advanced fields. Of course, the instrumentations are completely different. You need something better than just a prism you hold on your hand, but it's the same thing. You learn about barcodes of life by just diffusing light with prism. Other example would be basic fluid dynamics. You learn why a plane can fly. And then after you know that, why a plane can fly, you can apply that. Oh, so this is the reason why a car looks like this, why an F1 car looks like this, why it has these wings, why it has this spoilers, why it has this tiny bit going out, why does car has a hood shaped like this. You can start to appreciate the amount of engineering that is done to a car or at least a moving vehicle, or maybe a bullet train. You will understand why it's shaped like this, why there's this part, why there's that part. Oh, because of this part interferes with the flow separation, that's why it becomes like this, blah, blah, blah. So simple science will change your perspective, and maybe it will spark your interest.
Yeah, I mean, like you're saying, it would really expand your understanding of so many things. And in some people's cases, anyway, they might be able to tap into their creative aspects. And, you know, maybe they'll look at a car or an airplane, and even with basic knowledge, they could start asking questions, whether to themselves or someone who is already more knowledgeable in such a field. What if it was actually shaped like this instead? You know, who knows, that could, that simple question in someone's mind that would develop just from the basic understanding of how those things work could develop into something revolutionary. So
yeah, start from simple stuff. I always start with simple stuff.
So yeah, everybody in the audience, you know, look for some resources to start learning about science and engineering, and just understanding the basics of a lot of this is very useful. And, you know, with the tools we have today, just going on YouTube or using one of the MOOCs, the online education systems that exist, usually that are either free or cheap, you can learn so many skills, so many things, and maybe taking a little bit of time and learning a little bit more about the sciences could be beneficial to your life and what skills you're trying to do and a lot of things moving forward.
Yeah, and maybe I can add a little bit that we have something similar in our website. All you need to do is find it on the website. On the Space Education Center website, we have some workbooks.
Oh, yes. I'll make sure to add a link to that in the this podcast description, the JAXA Education Center.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you for all your interesting answers and information today. It was a pleasure having you on the podcast, Adiguena.
Thank you very much, Mr. Nikairo. Thank you very much for having me, and I wish everyone a good day.